Hello, my name is Michael Apted and I'm the director of World Is Not Enough. So welcome to my DVD commentary on the making of the film. One of the challenges of doing a Bond film is that you have to deliver a number of icons. You have to deliver the girls, the action, the gadgets, the humour, and something that was impressed upon me is exotic locations, which is why I shot this in Bilbao, the beautiful Guggenheim Museum. You have to redefine, I think, what exotic means, because in the days when the movie started, when the whole series of films started, exotic was palms, beaches, and whatever. But I think those days are long gone by. That's part of everybody's holiday plan. So I had to figure out other ways to open up the movie and to make it look unusual and interesting. Hence this scene here, which is an office scene, but we wanted to give it an extra dimension, so we decided to shoot it near the Guggenheim, which I think is one of the great buildings of the 20th century. So that came into my definition of exotic. You'll see other locations which you may not be the sort of place you want to take your vacations, but nonetheless I think they have an unusual side to them. There's a wonderful here in the scene use of back projection of translights, the skill of the cinematographer, Adrian Biddle. This scene inside here was shot in Pinewood, but you can see the Guggenheim outside, and it's very, very skillfully done, so I think you really do believe you're there. I think one thing this scene does is something that Pierce was very interested in. When I came aboard the project, he said to me, "Michael, give me stuff to do, give me scenes to play." And he was looking for good actors to work with and good interplay between them. And I see, and you see, or begin to see, the sort of variety that he was getting in his performance. There's a kind of meanness and nastiness here to him, how he can move from being tough into being funny, into being vulnerable, if you want, and sensitive to whatever. But that look there, I thought that's a terrific shot. That really, Bond is back. The whole meanness, in a sense, that Sean brought to it, I think Pierce has now made his own.
You can do that, can't you? One. Two.
Another thing interesting about this is the casting of Maria Grazia Cucinotto, playing the mysterious girl who's just left the room. I saw her for the leading role of Electra, but didn't really feel her English was quite up to that big part. But she said, I want to be in it. So I said, well, there is this tiny part at the beginning. She said, I'll do it. And again, that sort of showed me the attraction of the Bond franchise, that really terrific actors are happy to take quite small parts in it. And so someone like her, she was a tremendous success in a film called Il Postino. Her playing this small role really elevated the scene and really, I think, gave it a bit more edge. When we filmed in Bilbao, we had truly horrendous weather. I'd chosen the Guggenheim because of the titanium sheen to the building in the sunlight. It really sparkles and the sun moves all the way around it, so it seems to change shape in front of you. But sure enough, when we arrived, which is fairly typical of all the filming, it rained and we just had to shoot between showers, which was kind of disappointing, but I think the building still stands up. And this scene here with Pierce jumping out of the window is, I think, perhaps the first stunt scene that I shot on the film. And my heart was in my mouth, because it's dangerous stuff. When the stunt double jumps out of the window, there is nothing underneath him. This is for real, which is, I think, the attraction of the Bond films. We do our stunts for real. We don't do them with computer graphics, computer generated. We do them for real, and that was heart-wrenching moment. So this was the first stuff we did in the film, the stuff in MI6, which was me and Pierce finding our feet together and getting a language going. He'd just come off Thomas Crown Affair, and so we had to kind of make it up as we go along, and these are kind of tricky scenes that he had to play with Samantha and in a moment with Judi Dench.
Romantic.
So we were sort of finding our feet here. But he'd really laid his agenda out to me of wanting as much complexity and depth as he could get in the scenes with everybody. One thing to talk about when we filmed in Bilbao was the huge public interest in us. It was unbelievable. Vast numbers of crowds there. It was like the Beatles, 1960. It's intimidating to come aboard a Bond film, and events like that, when you see the kind of expectation and the interest in the film, it's unnerving. It's bad enough to be coming into a film as the new boy on the block, trying to at least keep the standard up, but also knowing that out there is a vast audience waiting to see what you can do. And I think we were all a little startled by the kind of pop star reception Pierce and the other actors got in Bilbao. The days in Pinewood were quieter, although I learned pretty early on that Bond is a public event, that every day on the set there were press and visitors and whatever, and there's never going to be those great private times you can have with yourself and the actors, yourself and the crew, that every move was being watched. It was a bit disconcerting at first, but I kind of got the hang of it. If you take this job on, it is a public event, and that kind of pursued me all the way through. I think it goes with the territory of directing a film.
King, the money.
So this is the beginning of the first big action scene, the pre-title action scene, which by legend has to be a real cracker. You're always supposed to deliver a big bang before the main titles. One of the difficulties with this was that it was quite a long sequence. We had a lot of story to cover. What I like about this pre-title stuff is that it does relate to the rest of the film. It isn't just a piece of grandstanding that you forget about and start the film after the titles. But we wanted to deliver this huge chase down the Thames before the title started, but we had a lot of plot to get through. So I think probably this is the longest pre-title sequence in the history of the franchise, which gave us cause for alarm, but I think it's such a stand-up, cracking sequence that it doesn't really matter whether it's 8, 9, 10 or 14 minutes. So this, of course, this whole sequence was a huge challenge to me, because what was I doing directing a Bond film? I'd never done an action film of this scale. I'd done action in other movies, but never anything like this. So why were they looking for someone who wasn't that experienced in this kind of work, someone who wouldn't normally gravitate to this kind of scene? Well, when I first went up for the job, when I started discussing it with the Broccolis, it sort of became clear that they wanted to make some readjustments, some little redressing balances, that maybe they didn't want wall-to-wall action. They were after a more complicated story, more complicated, interesting characters, to go back, in a sense, to the drama of the early Bonds, which made me feel comfortable, but still I felt a lot of anxiety about doing stuff like this. And I don't think I would have taken the job on if I hadn't realized or hadn't known what fantastic talent I had around me, the best people in the world. And this scene, I think, is a good example of how skillful the people that were supporting me and working with me were. Vic Armstrong, who did the second unit on this, all the stunts you see, he did. Simon Crane, the stunt coordinator, who'd just come off doing Private Ryan and Titanic, two pretty good credits. Chris Corbould, who was doing all the special effects, had done a lot of Bonds and a lot of other big movies. So in those key positions, Jerry Gavigan, the first assistant, had done a lot of Bonds, a lot of action films. Peter Lamont, the designer, again, he won an Academy Award for Titanic and had also done a numerous number of Bond films. So I had a very top-class group of people around me, which I think gave me the confidence to do this stuff. In pre-production, we went through all these sequences. We would draw them all up, do endless drafts of them, change them. It was like rewriting the script, rewriting the action sequences through storyboard artists, three guys working on it all the time. Because scenes like this are massively complicated. Vic is doing all the stunts. I go in with Pierce and do his bits and pieces. There's model shots, special effects shots, and some computer shots, mainly to clean up stuff that we can't quite figure out, or stuff that we need, in fact, to help us do particular stunts, cranes, whatever, we have to remove them. So all these scenes are very complicated. So they have to be storyboarded so everybody knows what they're doing. But what I found is that these storyboards didn't last very long. After about 20 minutes of filming, they were out the window, because when someone like Vic goes to work on this, then things happen. Things don't work, things do work, he has better ideas, and the whole sequence can begin to make small changes, but those small changes can have giant effects. So I think one of the toughest job for me in the whole film is really keeping track of everything, not just watching my own dailies. Oh, this little gag here, Pierce just did that. That was just something he thought of while we were shooting it. We had no idea that was going to happen, and that touching of the tie, which gets a huge laugh, was just a moment of inspiration. But the toughest thing for me was just keeping track of what everybody else was doing, watching my own stuff, but also watching everything Vic was doing, everything was happening with the special units, with the model units. So we got the feeling that everything would fit, everything would fall into place. A sequence like this took Vic about 5 weeks. I went on for a week with Pierce, but this was about 5-6 weeks work for him. Huge amount of stuff, and you can imagine, shooting in England where weather stays the same for about 20 minutes, the difficulty we had in grading this, matching this through sunshine and cloud and rain, almost everything except snow, I think. Here comes one of our big showpieces, the Millennium Dome. We were very anxious to make some nod towards the Millennium. The story really bears no relation to it, but we thought here was something that would give the film a sense of time and place. The place, the Thames, no one has ever filmed this amount of stuff on the Thames. It was amazing the access we were given on it. Bond seems to open doors for everything. They practically cleared the river for us to shoot on it, as long as we kept out of the tourist season. But anyway, we wanted to film a bit of the Millennium Dome, and we thought, what better than to do this hugely complicated balloon sequence, which can only be about a minute of film, but is everything from stuff that was shot live, like this stuff, to using green screens. That's an amazing stunt. I think that was one of the best moments Vic gave the film. That moment always gets a huge cheer. So this particular sequence, I think this is a real shot, but it's a tremendous mixture of green screen, of model work, like those helicopters. Stuff we did on the back lot at Pinewood, this stuff here with Maria, and the original location. And it's difficult and confusing, because I reckon this sequence we shot over about 4 months, bits and pieces here and there. That's a magnificent model shot that John Richardson did. There's a lot of terrific work of his in here. And this is fun, this bit of the stunt guy falling down. When we were doing this shot, he kept missing. He couldn't get hold of the rope. And I was thinking, oh, is he ever going to get it? And then Simon Crane said, why don't you use the stuff of him missing it? And you get much better feeling of how hard it is and how many rolls down there were. So that's our stand-up opening sequence, and now the main titles, which is another icon, and to me, mystifying. I don't know how these guys do this stuff. It's just dazzling work, and takes forever and ever to do, and I was so busy I saw very little of it. I'm involved to an extent in the song and the titles. I have to give a kind of general guidance. I made it clear to David Arnold, who was going to write the song, the sort of tone I needed, that we wanted something romantic and haunting. And it was very important to me that the song should be recorded and written early enough in the process that we could use the themes of the song all throughout the score of the film. Because I'd remembered how effective it was in The Spy Who Loved Me, that great song, Nobody Does It Better, that Hamlisch and Bear Sager wrote, that Carly Simon recorded, that you were able to use that as a love theme throughout the film. So I was insistent that at least we got a rough draft of this song out soon enough that it could be incorporated into the score, and I think it was. But again, with the titles, I just spoke in the most wide generalities to Danny Kleinman, who did the titles for me, saying oil is a theme, industry is a theme, and obviously girls are a theme, and it was about as vague as that, and Danny went off. And what was so difficult is you can never really tell what they're doing. They give you drawings which seem okay, then they start showing you a work in progress. But it's so odd and so primitive, and it never ever really comes together until he finishes it. And he kept saying that, and I was getting very kind of jumpy about it. He'd say, be all right, believe me, it's going to be fine. And you'd see some of the early work, and it looked really odd. But Michael and Barbara had done it all before, and so they were reassuring about it. And sure enough, I think it's a beautiful sequence, but it was nerve-wracking. And again, one of the icons that if you direct a Bond movie, you simply have to pay attention to and have to deliver. And of course, it's about the last thing you get. It takes so long and starts fairly late in the process. So again, you never really know what you have until the film is about to be finished. So I think this is a terrific one, way up to mark. So we were all thrilled with it. So I shot this scene at Stowe School. I loved the church and I loved that great line of plane trees. And this is the first entrance in of Sophie Marceau, who is the leading lady of the film. First time I met her, I knew I wanted her in it. It was a battle to get her, to convince people that she was the right one. She had qualities of vulnerability and she looked exquisite, and yet had a nice edge to her that I thought could really give the film, give the part life, because her relationship with Pierce was going to be the centerpiece of the film. I'd worked with Michael Kitchen, who is giving this piece of exposition, before. We'd worked together 20 years ago. I think I gave him his first role in a television film. I love him. I love his kind of natural style and the ease with which he does his stuff. It's as though he's saying it for the first time. So these were interesting design issues. We'd established that MI6 had moved up to the Scottish Highlands, which gave us a nice theme for all these settings, and Peter Lamont and Neil and all the art directors really went to town on giving this castle-like feel to all these particular scenes. It was great to be able to get away from the MI6 London syndrome, as it were, and give some fresh look to a lot of tricky scenes. This is a long section of exposition in the film, and to be able to give it this unusual visual appeal was very helpful.
Sorry, James. Em says you're off the active duty list until you're cleared by medical.
Dislocated collarbone. If any more tendons snap, I'm afraid you're going to be out of action for weeks.
Molly, I need a clean bill of health. You have to clear me for duty.
One of the tricky things of doing a Bond film is a scene with a girl where Bond has his way with some unsuspecting or suspecting creature of great beauty. Here, Selina Scott Thomas, who's a terrific actress, who again graced the film with her presence. And then following on with a Q scene. Everybody loves Q scenes with all the gadgets and whatever. Audiences love them, and if you can do them right, they're great fun. And I think these two worked out well, but when we were writing the script, it was hard to find the drama in them to deliver the the sexiness of this and the humour of the next and keep the idea of the story in the audience's head. Again, the gadgets, that's a real challenge. I decided that I would shoot this scene almost last in the film, so I would see what gadgets we would come up with while we were doing all the action sequences, and then be able to explain them as much as we wanted to in the cue scene. I felt if we shot the cue scene early on, we might use gadgets which we dropped from the action stuff, or we might be using gadgets in the action stuff which wouldn't appear in the scene. So that was a decision I made early on. I think it worked out.
I'll introduce you to the young fellow. I'm grooming to follow me.
We had an interesting casting issue here. We needed to find an assistant. We didn't want Desmond Q suddenly to disappear out of the film. We wanted to lay the ground for someone to come in and take over. We thought, who would be the best person in the world for that? And we thought, well, John Cleese, but he's never going to want to do it. Why would he want to do a small role like this and a continuing role? Well, I'd been at college with Cleese. We'd known each other since we were 18. We were at Cambridge together, reading law, and in the same soccer team. In fact, we support the same soccer team. So we asked him, and he said he'd love to do it. He'd always wanted to be in Bond, and this was great. So we got what we thought was the best possible assistant for Q, and the idea is John will take it over. But it's very taxing, I think, to think of gadgets, and people like Peter Lamont and Chris are wonderful at coming up with ideas, because again, there's such a high standard, and that's one of the signatures of the whole series, these gadgets, and so you have to come up with something that's memorable. I think in this scene, I had something else going for me. I had the introduction of John, so we had all the humour that's intrinsic in him, the relationship between John and Q, and also the sense at the end of the scene that maybe we were beginning to say goodbye to Desmond. So there's a nice sense of emotion as well as humour in this scene.
Seems well suited for the job. You're not retiring anytime soon. Are you?
Now pay attention, 007. I've always tried to teach you two things. First, never let them see you bleed.
And the second?
Always have an escape plan.
So now we're back on track with the story again. And this is just an example of just the massive pre-production that has to go into a film like this. The design of this scene, all the particular graphics, the recording of the newscaster, the filming of Sophie's little scene here, all had to be done in pre-production, so it was all ready for us when we came to shoot, and this was one of the first things we shot. But this sequence took months to design. And it became sort of overwhelming for me because I'd never had any experience in this all through the pre-production, particularly as day one of shooting approached, how much stuff had to be prepared. Some of it I wasn't going to shoot for 5 or 6 months. And I remember in that time really feeling overwhelmed by it all, thinking I'm never going to get through this stuff. How can I make decisions about the last sequence, which doesn't get shot till June, when I haven't shot a single thing, when I'm not going to do that for weeks and weeks and weeks, and to pay attention to these very skillful graphics and putting together all the elements of this is just an example of the kind of massive pre-production that one is saddled with when you direct this. I started in August, we started shooting in January, so it was a 5-month pre-production for what was a 6-month shoot. Again, this is another of Lamont's great medieval castle sets. But I think this is the first great example of what we were trying to do with the script and the character. We wanted to develop M. We have Judi Dench, one of the great screen actors in the world, so why not use her? So we were looking for ways to bring her out, not just bring the story out of the office, to bring her out emotionally. And I think fairly late on in the whole scriptwriting process, we began to develop these ideas of M's involvement in the story. So she would be connected to the story. She wouldn't just be barking orders out from behind the desk and abusing Bond and telling him to do this, do that. That M would have some investment in the story.
So he came to me.
And I'm pleased, I think, that we did manage to get some real emotion and tension between the two of them. We were able to use their great skills as actors. We weren't just doing exposition. We were really doing quite touching emotional stuff. And by building M into the story, into the history of Elektra and her father, it gave us all sorts of possibilities to bring M out of her office and into the field, and to make use of such a fine actress.
Yes.
The money in King's briefcase was precisely the same amount as the ransom demand.
So I think this is the sort of thing that Pierce wanted to do, that Pierce wanted a real stand-up relationship with M. He didn't just want to be in a kind of master-servant, so he was looking for difficult scenes to play with her. And these were hard to write and took us a long time to do, but I think it paid off. And now we come to one of Mara Bryan's coup de théâtre, these great graphics. This is where we did use computer-generated graphics to help us, the whole idea of this hologram. And we thought this is an intriguing way of introducing Robert Carlyle into the film as the villain. We, in fact, had a scene earlier on, in fact, near the very beginning of the film with Carlyle. But we felt this was a much stronger entry for him, much more mysterious, since the film is going to look like this is Bond against Renard, Brosnan against Carlyle. So to give him a strong and as big an impact as we could when we first get a sense of him. But I'd never done these kind of graphics, this kind of hologram, so this was an adventure for me, watching the thing developed over weeks and weeks. We shot this stuff on motion control, which is very complicated and very time-consuming, and then it's taken away and they start developing it. And it's interesting to have to comment on it and have to try and figure out what's in these technicians' mind as they do it, and to try and play a meaningful role, but somehow we came up with it.
Elektra.
M.
One of the other icons of the film, I think, is always the humour, that you can never take it too seriously. So even in dramatic pieces of exposition, it's always nice to have jokes, and Pierce is brilliant at this. And I think one of the keys of the humour is that all the humour has to be within character. You can't have actors nudging and winking the audience, saying, oh, we're in a Bond film, we're having fun. They have to be in the story, the characters have to be in the story. And the humour has to come from the situation.
Shadows stay in front or behind. Never on top.
So one of the great joys for me of doing this film was the ability to be able to travel. I have a lot of experience in documentary films, and one of the first things I did when I started work on this was to exercise my documentary muscle and take everybody out to Azerbaijan, to the capital of Azerbaijan, Baku, because the story is set in the Caspian. It's about bringing oil and gas out of the Caspian across this very volatile part of the world. I wanted to go out there and see what it looked like. Again, this fits into the whole notion of exotic locations. Well, as I say, these are places you might not want to go on vacation, but they are incredibly unusual, those vast oil fields, and as we'll see later, the great city of oil that's been built in the Caspian. So we went out to Baku to film that stuff, which was very complicated because there's no infrastructure there at all, and we had to take everything with us. And it was a difficult, but I think valuable, process because none of that stuff had ever been filmed before. And so we were able to put something fresh into a Bond film. And this actor, Ulrik Thomsen, is very interesting. He was the star of Festen, a great Danish film, a great art film. I'd seen the film and liked him, and then found that he was interested and wanted to be in the Bond film. So in lots of really quite small parts, I was able to get very distinguished actors from all over the world, which I think gives us an international appeal. It's not just a load of English or American actors putting on funny voices. This is a truly European cast of the highest quality. And this location was very difficult to find. We were going to shoot this originally in Turkey, but the political situation drove us out of there. And we had to relocate in Spain. And we found one location that I liked, but then that was, we were thrown out of it because it was a breeding ground for vultures and eagles. So then we found this. I needed something that had a slightly magical look to it, an unusual natural phenomenon. And these great kind of toadstool rocks were perfect for me. The interior of the temple was built at Pinewood, and I think that was the first thing Sophie shot. Again, a film like this is a confusing jigsaw of Pinewood and the rest of the world. But this was difficult stuff. It was fairly remote, near an interesting town in central Spain called Cuenca. But these extras are really first class, and they're all local people. None of them have done anything like this before, and it's so exciting to work with this kind of crowd, because they're interested, it's novel for them, they're fresh, they're not jaded with it, and they look great. They look like the real stuff. We're supposed to be here in Azerbaijan, and I think these people have a real look of European peasants about them, and in fact, some of them are, but some of them are bank managers and school teachers and whatever, but they did all this stuff with great enthusiasm, and that really does make it easier to do if you have to push extras around and get them to show enthusiasm. That can be hard. And this scene is a triumph for Jerry Gavigan, the first assistant, moving all these crowds around, moving all this heavy equipment around, which was given to us by Caterpillar. There's about $8 million worth of props here. This is a huge assistant directorial achievement, this scene. He had Spanish assistant directors to help him, but really he had to design all the background. Every shot is full of people, machinery, and whatever. And he has to take the load of that. I'm working with the principal actors, and he is really delivering all that for me. And back in Pinewood, towards the end of the shoot, bring these graphics in. And again, to make it look as though we're actually on the building site, we shot this on the back lot of Pinewood and had some trucks and people running around outside to make it look convincing. It would have been not cost-effective to have done this sort of scene in Spain, but I think we made this work fairly seamlessly. With the transmitter inside that set off. I think this is a key scene for Sophie, too, because we wanted to change the idea of Bond girls. We wanted Bond girls, these Bond girls, to have a real dramatic role in the film, to drive the film. And here is a Bond girl standing up to Bond, not just, as it were, falling over in front of him. We wanted an actress who could really push the story along, be convincing, and play this very, very complicated role.
I hope you know how to ski then.
I came prepared for a cold reception.
John Saru, who is playing Gabor there, also, I think, gives the film another texture. It's hard with lots of villains and supporting players. You want to make them memorable. With a complicated plot and so many characters and so many villains in it, it's sometimes good to get a very distinctive physical type so you can remember who people are. This is the beginning of what proved to be perhaps the most difficult sequence to shoot in the film. The storytelling is very hard, but the conditions were just dreadful. We were shooting at Chamonix in the French Alps, and at the time we were there on one side of the mountain, we were filming on the other side, there were these fatal and devastating avalanches which killed numbers of people. We had to stop, give them our equipment, move out, and then could only come back in again when all the trouble was over and the weather had improved. So this was an incredibly difficult sequence. And also a big challenge musically, because clearly there's an action sequence coming up and threat coming up, but I didn't want the music to get ahead of me. And there's a feeling I wanted in the music of romance, and yet they're not romantically attached yet. I also wanted energy in the sequence, so it was a real challenge to David. And I think he came up with a piece of music that had a great scale to represent the kind of the great outdoors, had a hint of romance in it without giving it away, and also managed to give the music some scale without threat. So that was a challenge I think he met very well here. One of my difficulties doing the sequence was that Bond had already done two or three ski sequences in its franchise. You have to not only compete with other action films out there with your action stuff, but you have to compete with the franchise. And so we had to find a way of making this original. I went back and looked at the other ski sequences, so we knew what we had to beat and we knew what we couldn't do at the risk of repeating ourselves. So we came up with this idea of these rather sinister-looking parahawks or paraglides, which I think we found in a catalogue, and then Simon and Vic Armstrong went off to Florida and to Canada to have a look at them and bring them back and adapt them for our use. But this was murderously difficult for Vic. These things could only fly in certain wind conditions. If it was too much wind, they couldn't stay up. So apart from doing all the explosions and the gunshots and whatever, there was also all the difficulty of keeping these things in the air. Again, dealing with weather and very, very poor conditions. The sequence went on and on. This was an action scene where Vic did most of the work, all the stunts, and I came in and did Pierce and Sophie and put them into the film. This sequence, as I say, went on and on. We went, came back again, went again, and it's just very slow work. It was a long distance to travel to the location. The location was remote. You didn't want anywhere where there were other skiers. You didn't want any sense of ski tracks. And whether it was Vic or whether it was me, we used to end up with very few hours of the day to shoot the stuff by the time we got up there, and we had to get back before it got dark. It made the shooting day very quick. We had working lunches, food was brought round to us, so we could keep going and make best use of the daytime. But this was a sequence, I think, that we had a lot of trouble editing, putting together. We tried it many, many ways to try and tell the story, to make these things threatening, to give the idea that Bond was luring these machines into the forest, that Sophie was making her way outside the forest into safety, and to find different and intriguing ways of blowing up these various paraglides and giving some tension and texture to the story. What's difficult, I think, with action scenes is that you don't want to shut your brain off and just watch a load of action and forget the story. You've got to keep the whole idea of the story alive. I think I learned that doing musical films, that you can't stop a film for a song. You've got to somehow keep the drama going. And I think with this, it was particularly difficult. We wanted to be exciting. We wanted to get the feeling that Bond was in threat. But the whole climax of the scene really had to have some real emotional impact. And all this sort of stuff was a tremendous mixture between real shooting like this, stunt doubles, Pierce doing his own pieces, and also some help from CGI, from computer graphics. For example, all these shots here were enhanced with computers and them going down the avalanche. We did some of this at Pinewood. Then the gadget with John Cleese paid off there, and then we got into the scene, which I think is a crucial scene, and for me the whole point of doing the sequence, the emotional connection that is now established between Bond and Elektra. I think without this part of the scene, the ski sequence would have just been an action scene and we would have moved on and forgotten about it. But this, to me, this moment here, which we shot in Pinewood in great difficulty with phony snow and wind machines and all that, and to ask them to get this kind of emotional intensity, I think it was very difficult, but I think they pulled it off. So the love story develops, which is perhaps a good place to discuss how the script came into being. That it was originally the work of two English writers, Robert Wade and Neil Purvis, who really put the story together and made the film coherent, made the film make sense, and work out all the twists and turns of the story. But we felt that we weren't really getting a strong sense of the women in the film, so we brought another writer in who wrote Elektra's role and M's role and Denise's role. But when we did that, we then found that we'd really put Bond out of balance, that Bond was a sort of a supporting player in these scenes. So then Bruce Feirstein came in, who had worked on the previous two Bond films, who really did write Bond great. So he came in and he did the last work on the script, which was to give Bond more character, give Bond more to do in the scenes, and also to make the film as humorous as he could. So I think we were lucky. We had sets of writers, if you want, who all brought something different to the film. They didn't tread on each other's toes. The boys gave us the story and the sense of it, and Bruce gave us Bond and most of the humor, I think. So we were lucky with that, I think, and it worked out well.
I can't do that.
I thought it was your job to protect me.
Again, I think this shows how, at this point in the film, Sophie can do the vulnerability and the victim so well, and that she's dazzling. When I met her, I fell in love with her and knew that Bond could fall in love with her, the audience could fall in love with her, and you'd never get any sense that she wasn't who she was, or she wasn't meaning something else, or that there was any subtext at work. She's her own woman, but she's modern and beautiful and has a mind of her own. So we go to the casino, where I think we have one of the best Bond gadgets, one that I wouldn't mind having, the famous glasses. Doing this sort of scene is tough, because if Bond has done 2 or 3 ski scenes, he must have done 200 or 300 casino scenes, and to give this some kind of freshness or originality was tricky, and this is the way we chose to do that. Pretty exciting stuff, I think. And again, we have to try and keep the story moving, but it's a good place for some humour. We always have to look for fun, and again, Pierce is so good at this kind of understated performance. We know what he's seeing, we don't see it, but he communicates the fun of it all so well. Action scenes are action scenes, but also spotted throughout the film are these little moments of action and violence, all of which have to be carefully rehearsed and thought out, and Simon Crane would design all these moments, these little fights that took place. He'd rehearse it very carefully with stunt doubles. They'd videotape it, show it to me, I would sign off on it, approve it, and then we'd rehearse it with the main actors. Even something like this, which is tiny but has to be witty and effective. This next piece of casting I'm pleased with. This is Goldie, a celebrity in London, if you want, a rap singer, a disc jockey, a man about town, who hadn't done much acting before, but when he came in to see me, I thought, this is a Bond person, and he really turned out well. And so I think we developed his part. But this is one of the great assets to the film, Robbie Coltrane, who again has this great gift of being able to be funny, but in character. He can do jokes, he can almost do stand-up within his role, but you never feel he isn't who he says he is. He never takes you outside the film. And with John Cleese and with Robbie, I felt they were two huge assets in giving the film as much humour as we could give it.
I'll see you later, Mr. Bond.
of money where your mouth is.
This casino is supposed to be in Baku, but there isn't really anything quite like that there, although it is a Wild West town with places much seedier than this, but this sort of thing, because there all the battles are being fought for who's going to get the oil out of the Caspian, which is going to be an important factor in the world politics over the next 20 years. And so there's a feeling in this strange little city in the middle of Central Asia of all these characters. And when I was casting this and casting the crowd, I wanted to give it a look of many nationalities, of wealth, of sleaze, everything that you could be associated with people out to make a fast buck. Because this is an exciting little town, and although nothing quite as grand as this exists, it's fun to give a feeling of the old Wild West, hence all the guns and all the weaponry. We shot this at, an RAF officer's mess in outside London, so you can see how the RAF live. Not bad. In the next piece we see Elektra come in, and that opens up the whole question of her costumes. She's a beautiful woman and a brilliant actress, but also we wanted to make some fashion statement. We wanted the Elektra wardrobe to be all over the fashion pages, so Lindy Hemmings had to spend months trying to figure out with Sophie what she could wear, how to give it this kind of exotic look for someone whose heart and soul was in Muslim Azerbaijan, and yet who was sophisticated in the ways of the West. So that gave us lots of challenges all the way through the film, how we could get a kind of exciting and unusual and coherent costume for her. Coming up now is a most important cameo. One of the obligations a director has is to give a cameo to the film's producer, Michael G. Wilson, on the right, who is offering up to Sophie her tab. I think this is one of Michael's less demanding roles, but nonetheless, he's in the film. He had a tuxedo, so he got the job.
Wait. Bury the top three cards.
You're determined to protect me, aren't you?
Perhaps from yourself. You don't have to do this.
Robbie's character had appeared in Goldeneye, and it's always fun in Bond movies to get some continuity of performance, particularly if you have an asset like Robbie. It's hard because I suppose not everybody's seen Goldeneye and they might not even remember it that well, so you have to recreate the character. And yet he still has that same limp he had in the last one and some of the banter that he had with Bond. But I think it adds to the familiarity that people love so much of the franchise that certain faces keep reappearing. And that's one of, again, the challenges of doing the film, which is to make it timely, to make it a good contemporary story, and yet play into that timelessness, the tuxedos, the exoticism, the beautiful costumes, and the characters that people love, like Coltrane, like Judi Dench. So it becomes like an old friend. So hopefully you have both a timely and a timeless element to the film, which I think separates it off from everything else in the marketplace and gives it its unique style and tone. Now we come to the major entrance in the film of Bobby Carlyle as Renard. Quite a late entrance, so we wanted to make it as big as and effective as we could. And we shot it on the back lot one freezing night in Pinewood. But this is a very important scene to establish the kind of viciousness and cleverness of Renard. Took a lot of thought about casting Bobby. He's not a very big guy, but I'd seen him play a villain in a television show he'd done actually with Robbie Coltrane called Cracker, when he had his hair shaved short and was extremely sinister. We knew he was a terrific actor and also a very up-and-coming movie star. The success of The Full Monty and many other films he'd done showed he had huge range. And while we wanted to deliver a really straight-down-the-line Bond villain, we also had plans to make it a bit more complicated than usual, to show some compassion and vulnerability in him, And we thought he was the sort of actor that could really bring something to the table, that he wouldn't turn Renard, the villain, into a cardboard character, that he would give flesh and blood. That was something I think I was trying to do with all this casting, is to give it as much reality and as much humanity and as much complication as I could without taking my eye off the ball and delivering the main thrust of villain against hero. So this was Bobby's first scene, and I think the first scene he shot, and a very difficult scene to do, but I think you get a feeling here of someone in the film to be reckoned with. So the love story continues, and you have to deliver some real heat and sexuality, and yet within the context of Bond, with the context of the rating. And I'm pleased with this, because I think this isn't just double entendres, this is the real thing. This feels kind of sexy and emotional. It's interesting dealing with Bond and in romantic situations, because one of the dynamics of making the film is Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson, who have a sense of the whole overview of Bond's character. And here we are trying to put Bond in love with Sophie here, with Elektra. And we wanted to write stuff about Bond kind of being vulnerable and revealing himself, and they would say, no, Bond never talks about himself, which made it hard on us, but they're right. You have to have some continuity in the character, continuity that starts all the way back from Sean. So although the character is different, played by different actors with the same character name, James Bond, they're all different, which is one thing I think why the franchise keeps alive and strong, and yet there still are qualities that they all have to share. And one of them is that Bond is very closed about his past life. So when Sophie asks him questions about his life, she asked him one in an earlier scene, have you ever lost someone? And she asks him a question now, he doesn't answer, he evades it. Which put a lot of pressure on us writing this stuff, because if you're going to have two people sort of fall in love, it's better if they tell each other stuff about themselves, but that was not available to us. And that's an interesting role that Michael and Barbara play. As new writers, new directors, new actors come in, they have to keep the character consistent. This is a piece of Lamont magic. That building in the back, which you all think, I hope, is part of Elektra's magnificent house, is in fact a piece of painted wood, which we did in the back of Pinewood. We couldn't afford to shoot a scene like that in Turkey or Azerbaijan, so Peter made a kind of photocopy of it and had it painted, and we did it on the back lot. It's amazing how clever people are, how imagination, even at a big budget film like this, how you can save money and cut corners and just use your wits and really put stuff up on the screen there which is totally convincing but really is nothing but paper and paint. Interesting challenge in this sequence is a musical one. It's not a big driving action sequence at all, but we are moving the story. I love the way that actor kept his eyes open, even when the torch was in his eye. That was brilliant. And I never realized that until I saw the rushes. I should have congratulated him for that. But the challenge with the score here is to drive the sequence along, but not to make it too heavy, not make it too serious. We have a long way to go, and this is Bond in motion, but not Bond in particular threat, and not Bond really knowing what he's doing. So I asked David here to keep it a little lighter, the sequence, so he could save some of the big guns for scenes that were to come. We shot this in an airport outside London, Northolt Airport, and imported this plane, which had to travel all over the world because of this strange order that we shot sequences. I think this plane appeared in France and Spain and maybe even Turkey. But we flew it in from France for this particular scene. But what we were trying to work on here is a sequence which we thought would be entertaining, where Bond is simply flying by the seat of his pants. He has no idea where he is, no idea where he's going, he's just following a hunch, or following his nose.
Okay, come on! Let's get out of here.
And I think from this moment on, once Bond takes off in the plane, the narrative takes off. Up to now, we've been setting up the characters, setting up the story, laying the groundwork for it. And I got the feeling now the film was in real motion.
Excellent.
So we must be 30, 40 minutes in. But I feel that that gives the film a distinctive rhythm. You don't want blood-curdling action from the very beginning. Otherwise, I think it tires an audience out. You have to gear it up, put it into motion. And I felt by this time the characters were in motion. Elektra was in everybody's eye. We thought we knew who she was. Renata's established. And now Bond is on the move. It's been fairly static up to now, which is quite a challenge in a Bond film. Quite a lot of dialogue. But I think the variety of locations, the exotic locations, and the exotic look of Sophie has carried us through. Now we begin to up the ante a bit and get into the real story as the story unfolds in front of us and in front of Bond. We know no more than Bond knows. I think always a good trick in a film, if the audience is ahead of the hero, it can make you impatient with the hero. If you're trying to catch up with him or at least keep up with him, I think that gives a greater sense of energy to the proceedings. This is a location that we ended up with, which I'm thrilled about, in central Spain, after we had pulled out of Turkey and been thrown off the vulture breeding ground. This is where we landed up, in this miles from anywhere, this sweltering hot plain where we could put stuff, drive vehicles and do lots of explosions. And Spain is a terrific place to film because there's a large infrastructure and a lot of films work there, so they're very used to it all and they have a lot of very highly trained, skillful personnel that you can use. We were very dependent here on the Spanish ADs. All the people were local and they were able to keep the day moving. And now we see the last of our main characters. This is the sumptuous Denise Richards playing Christmas Jones. She is the last major character to appear. And she has a difficult role, perhaps a less developed role than some of the others. So I needed someone who could bring a lot of individuality and kind of flair to it. Also, in some ways, she's most traditional. I mean, she is your real vintage Bond girl, with everything that means. But I still wanted someone who could show intelligence and had a lot of spunk and fire to her, who could stand up to Bond, who could do banter and repartee with Bond, and who you might have a chance of believing that she really does do the job she says she does. It's always a scary moment when someone who looks like Denise says, "I'm a nuclear scientist."
Doctor? Aren't you forgetting?
But I needed someone who had this kind of vitality, and also someone, as we'll see going down the road of the film, was also prepared to do a lot of action.
Yeah, Chelsea, Foxford Bay.
So this whole exterior was shot in Spain, and with the help of a model shot here, we moved down into a huge set that we built at 007 stage on Pinewood, and I did the majority of this scene because this was one of the action scenes that was really actor driven, and I must have spent well over a month on this freezing cold set which is a nuclear testing site in Kazakhstan, which was constructed on this, I think it's the biggest stage in the world, and we pretty much filled it with this set, although even some of it is still backings and photographs and whatever to give depth everywhere we go. It also has a tank in it, so you can get different levels. And so down here in the base of the set, this is a water tank. We didn't use the water here, but it gives us an opportunity to create different depths. And this was a very difficult scene to write, because this is what we've been waiting for 40 minutes, the first confrontation between Bond and Renard. And I think if we'd had any queries about how good Bobby Carlyle would be in the role, it evaporated on this scene. He was absolutely terrific, and I think rather shook Pierce up how strong Bobby could be and how hard Pierce was going to have to work to match him and to get on top of him. But in the middle of this action scene, it's tough to have a scene of 2 pages of dialogue to keep it interesting and moving along. But all this stuff is real, the hydraulics of the bomb, all this stuff.
What do you believe in? Preservation of capital? Go ahead, shoot me. Then welcome it.
We started building in October and shot this late January. And what's kind of difficult directing a Bond film is everything's sort of done back to front. The first thing you're given is a release date. I was told this film would be in the cinemas November the 19th, 1999. When would we finish shooting so we'd have enough time to do the post-production? Therefore, when would we start shooting? When would we start building? So in some ways this set had to be built before we had written the scene properly. And that's tough on everybody. It's tough on Peter Lamont and his team, who have to create things for me. We're not quite sure what's being said in it. But that's the way it is with blockbuster movies like this. They have their release date and you have to make it. And you have to tie everything into that.
They're stealing the bomb.
I said drop it!
So this was a sequence that I pretty much did without help from the second unit, apart from a few explosions at the end. And it's a tough scene to approach because you have a set, albeit a big set, but there's a large action sequence. And a lot of stuff has to go on. You have to make it interesting. There's a strong dramatic core to this, which is Bond keeping tags on Renard and Renard trying to get away with the bomb. And so how do you come up with ideas to vary it? Because there's a lot of gunfire in here, and gunfire can get extremely tedious, noisy and tedious. So this was really a whole collaboration, months of collaboration between the design of the set, what Lamont could give me, and also with what Chris Corbould could give me in terms of special effects and special props. You saw as Bond walked in, you saw a kind of railway, a kind of low piece of railway stuff, which will come in handy later. But it's a question of finding incident to keep this interesting and to keep it moving along. Here, coming up, we use an important gadget, the watch. So gadgets come to bear. Stunts will come to bear. But it's a question of how you can make the gunfire and the fighting unusual and memorable and just not repetitive. And that really is just hard work. Simon Crane would try things with his stunt guys, and again, they would practice them on the set, this sort of stunt, to make sure it worked well and that Pierce could do some of it, and when we came to shoot it would all be ready. But then he and I would talk about this big chase down the tunnel, which is after all not a very long tunnel, and we wanted to create some drama and a lot of incident, and he would just try things, run things by me. Different scenarios, different hits, using this little truck that he's pushing, using the doors, trying to get the most out of the set, and sometimes going to Peter and saying, what can you give me? What can you give me? All I've got is one 200-foot tube. I need some stuff in it. So we would build those little balconies on the side, which had large kind of tins on them, so we could use those. And the whole idea of pushing the bomb on a chain gave us an opportunity to use that chain later on. So everything had to have a kind of multi-use. But this was a very difficult scene to conceive. And this particular moment, when this little kind of piece of railway equipment is kind of crushed, was a huge amount of effort for special effects to make stuff that could take the weight of being crushed, could lift up, and could finally break. Again, Pierce had to do a lot of this work because this is a real character-driven stunt sequence. You had to be in on him. You couldn't just take a lot of wide shots and get the audience to believe there was any drama at work. And in cutting the film, too, that was difficult, to keep it moving and to know when to go away from Renard and Bond and go back to what Christmas is doing. So you kept her alive without spoiling the rhythm of the sequence. This is one of my fondest memories. I must have done 15 takes of this particular gunshot, and we could never hit it on the right place because the guy who was putting it on was sat at a slightly different angle, couldn't tell if it was exactly on Bobby's forehead. So the outtakes of that are sort of comical, with this splodge going all over Carlisle. But eventually we got it, and he was very patient. So this was very dramatic, this huge explosion in here, which Vic and I did some of each between us. And this is Pierce really being tremendously game and actually doing a lot of this stuff with these flames not far behind him. And when he flies through this door, he was actually alight. And when we did the next shot in the sequence, he was alight again. And he's very accommodating about this. I imagine a lot of actors who wouldn't want to know about that sort of stuff, of being set fire to, but he's very, very game to do it and give it a try and never complains. This was the sort of stuff that Vic and I did together. Vic would do these big explosions, and then I would put the actors into it. But again, when this particular scene, I had done most of it, and then he came in and finished it off, not even really working from storyboards by this point, but working from the cut footage that I gave him. And that's really what I did with his stuff. I would see his cut footage and see what I had to fit in to make it, as it were, of whole cloth. And now we are back outside in Spain, doing a very big explosion, all of which is genuine. There's no trickery there. That's the real thing. That was extremely hard to do. And perhaps our biggest special effect in the whole film, this huge explosion here, which I think had the locals kind of gobsmacked in kind of amazement at the amount of stuff that we were using there. And with that sort of explosion, you really only have one take at it. If we got it wrong, God knows what we would have done. We'd burn the tent. We probably only had one tent, and even if we were going to do it again, it would have taken us another day to set it up. So we invested a lot of time and money in this particular gadget in MI6 because we didn't want MI6 to look dull in comparison with the other parts of the movie. Once we had the film in motion, the story going and things blowing up and everything moving, we needed to keep this MI6 stuff alive. So we built this complicated set which allowed us to project that map from underneath the floor. And with this, in fact, you do the reverse of what I normally like to do. This shot of Electra was one I made look messy, untidied it. Rather, usually you're tidying things up on films. Here it was so beautiful and clean an image that we decided to try and make it look more authentic and look as though it was actually being broadcast from Azerbaijan and a little untidy. So this is probably again, a key scene in the film where, in the whole developing dynamic of the Elektra Bond relationship, where we are now getting suspicious of Elektra. Is she what we think she is? And this is a terrific scene to kind of wrong foot both Bond and the audience. When I think you believe everything Elektra says, and really Bond seems to be talking gobbledygook, although he has a lot of evidence, he thinks, to suggest that Elektra might not be who she says she is. This is a very powerful performance in this scene.
Chat this morning, knew all about us, knew about my shoulder, knew exactly where to hurt me.
Are you saying Renard is the man who's trying to kill me?
Drop the act. It's over.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I think you do. It's called Stockholm Syndrome. Common in kidnappings. Young, impressionable victim. Sheltered. Sexually inexperienced. A powerful kidnapper. Skilled in torture, manipulation. Something snaps in the victim's mind. The captive falls in love with her.
I think this sequence is really her at her best, and she's one of the best actresses I've ever worked with in terms of what she can do with her eyes.
You disgust me.
How she can suggest emotion and pain without ever becoming sloppy or sentimental. I think this is a terrific tour de force, this scene of hers.
So you knew. You knew all the time that he was out there, that he was coming for me, and you lied. You used me. You used me as bait.
And Pierce warned to her. I mean, Pierce and she got on really well, and I think he knew how good she was, and we all had a lot of respect for her, and I think Pierce really stepped up and really gave a terrific performance in his stuff with her.
Hello.
Another beautiful set from Peter, supposedly Azerbaijan, with all those mixtures of Eastern and Western dressing and decoration. And again, exotic costumes for Elektra, and yet without ever making the scene unreal or unbelievable. This was one of the few scenes we shot on location in England. It's a factory where they build cellular phones, and kind of strange place with this wonderful kind of tube suspended in the air. But here now we're back in Pinewood. So this was a tricky set with a lot of people in it. And I began to develop a style of shooting on this, which I never really used before, which is to shoot almost everything on multiple cameras. Even a sequence like this with M and Bond, I would always shoot it on two cameras. It made it a joy to cut, and also, I think, gave us much more continuity of performance. And Adrian Biddle, who photographed it, seemed perfectly willing to try that. He wasn't protective about lighting particular close-ups or whatever. I mean, he did a beautiful job, but he allowed me to shoot on two cameras. And I think that's something I'll always try and do. You get magnificent edits. And generally with a scene like this, with a lot of people, I would shoot on two or three or four cameras sometimes, because I felt with an exposition scene, you need a lot of material, a lot of different shots. Action kind of shoots itself in many ways. You know what you have to do, and you can see where to put the camera, but this sort of stuff, a sort of scene like this, needs a lot of energy. Nothing much is happening except people talking and looking. These graphics are very helpful, and that again was a big pre-production issue and a lot of planning, a lot of work. But again, it's to keep some visual excitement in the scene without anybody doing very much apart from walking to A to B. So I shot a lot of material in here, a lot of different cuts and coverage in here.
Maybe. How far is that rig from the terminal? And how fast is it traveling?
Quite different, really, from any film I'd ever done before. But as I said, a kind of style that I developed on this that I think I want to carry through.
Can you get me out there? Of course.
If you're editing as you go along, which we have to because we have a very long shooting period and a very small editing period. In the script, there was no scene in here, but as I put the film together, I realized that between Christmas and Bond or leaving that room and them going into the pipeline, it was a direct cut. And I'd shot the two bits and put them together, and it just didn't work at all. It was just too abrupt. So we decided to shoot that stuff in the helicopter and to send another unit out to shoot from a helicopter of a pipeline, which was in North Wales, because I felt we needed some air in there, some space. And if I hadn't been cutting when I went along, I wouldn't have noticed that. I think that's something I've learned a long time ago. I know Stanley Kubrick never used to cut a frame until he'd finished, but I like seeing what I'm doing as I go to see whether I want to change things or fix things. Now, this sequence is our one big CGI scene, computer graphics, and they're sat pretty stationary on these pods being shaken about and having wind blown at them, but all these tunnel shots are a great achievement of the computer graphic. Difficult to do, difficult to get them consistent, difficult to get the speed correct, but a terrific job. And this stuff, although it's a dramatic sequence, we shot very quickly. All this stuff on the pod, I think I shot in a couple of days. This, in terms of the story, is a kind of turning point when you begin to realize that Elektra isn't who you think she is. And there's a shot coming up which I'm very kind of pleased with, which is a shot with Judy and Sophie, where without anything being said, and it's just with the flick of an eye, I think you get the feeling that Elektra might be involved in some of this in some sort of way. There's this particular moment here. I felt that the tunnel stuff was difficult, and also I didn't want to be stuck in the tunnel for a long time, so I needed to keep M and Elektra alive. We were always looking for ways to keep them going so I could make the tunnel stuff less sequential and I could jump it along a bit more. And we didn't have anything really for them to say, so it was just a creation of a mood between the two actresses, which I think was effective and helps make this tunnel stuff move quicker, because you're not always in it. You can cut away to it. Just adds a texture and dimension to it. And there again is a shot that, a model shot, that's part built and part a real pipeline that John Richardson did. But all this stuff was done on a static pod. It all had to be re-recorded. All the dialogue had to be redone because there was so much noise going on with wind machines and banging around, and these graphics were put on afterwards. They were shot on a green screen. So it was a real mishmash of all sorts of different styles of filmmaking. But it seems to have worked out. And again, the big explosion which follows this is one of Mr. Richardson's great model shots, when trees are put to scale and the pipe is put to scale. And it's, I think, totally convincing. And this, of course, is the large turning point in the script, when you realize that Elektra is, in fact, the villain. So for Sophie and for me, this was a huge challenge, this role, because if you thought she was a villain at the beginning of the relationship, then Bond looks foolish, falling in love or committing part of himself to a villain. So she has to appear vulnerable and innocent when she starts out, but by this time she has to have the chops of a villain. She has to be believable as someone who's manipulative and cruel. So it's a colossally difficult part, and I think we all realized, Barbara and Michael and myself, that if she couldn't work, if whoever played Elektra didn't work, really the story would fall apart. And when I first met her, as I said, I felt, of all the people I met, she had that ability to be charming and yet manipulative, and not to reveal her manipulation until it was called for. We'd seen her in Braveheart, but really this is by far the largest part she's ever had to do in the English language, so it's a real breakthrough for her. This was a truly difficult day's filming, but we had a lot of trouble with this, and I think it's turned out to be quite a funny scene with one of the best comic moments in it. We shot this round the back of Pinewood in Black Park, a great kind of feat of art direction and properties, and putting all those pieces in and the fire in and whatever, but it was, as ever on this film, raining, and so we had to shoot between the showers. But what are they going to do with the other half? Nothing ever worked for us with the weather, but then other things did work for us, so I'm not complaining.
But the world's greatest terrorist running around with 6 kilos of weapons-grade plutonium can't be good. I have to get it back, or somebody's going to have my ass.
First things first.
Bun to Robinson, do you copy?
By the way, before we go any further, I just want to know, what's the story with you and Elektra?
But every single cut was really very difficult to make. You have good days and your bad days, and sometimes you don't know which is which. When you think you've done well, you haven't, and when you think it's being a nightmare, it turns out good, and that was one of the days when we thought it was almost a write-off, but the stuff turned out good. Part of the joys and adventures of filmmaking.
There's one critical element here I may have overlooked.
What, more plutonium?
No. The Luger.
And now the story moves into Istanbul, which proved to be a very difficult place for us to film. The politics there were very volatile when we were supposed to go in. So we decided not to take the whole unit in and just to go in with a small unit. And these shots that we did on the Bosphorus, that location, Maiden's Tower, is a real place that sits in the middle of the Bosphorus, and the rest of this, of course, is another piece of production design magic. But I went into Istanbul with a very small guerrilla unit and with some doubles, and we did some backgrounds because Istanbul is the center of the story, so we needed material. But we really couldn't take the risk of taking a whole unit with movie stars in there, so we had to get what we could and patch it together and hope that we sold Istanbul as Istanbul and hope that we sold it as one of the kind of central locations in the film. In the scenes which are coming up, I think we really get to have the real payoff of having Robert Carlyle and Judy Dench and Sophie playing these roles that they bring of kind of real depth to them. It isn't just cardboard stuff, this. These are three of the best actors in films doing really good, well-written scenes. Not easy to shoot, otherwise. Small set. I didn't want to make it look big. It had to sort of fit the real location that we had in the Bosphorus. So I was inclined to use long lenses on this and resist any temptation to use very wide shots. So not a lot of space to move around, which was fine by Judy, since I remember she had a bad back and could barely stand. But it was thrilling directing this. I think these are two of the best actors in British films, so it was an honor to have them. And the scene worked well. I remember having a nervous breakdown when I read the scene the night before. It had the direction. Renard brings a clock out of his pocket. I thought, holy cow, how's he supposed to have a clock in his pocket? So I quickly rushed to the art department. I said, can you give me a load of props here? Everything, so we could stick a clock in it and it wouldn't look too ridiculous. And so they saved my backside. I felt a little bad about it that I hadn't prepared it properly and hadn't noticed it. It had slipped through in all the script sessions we'd had. But I think it's kind of convincing that we find this key prop on this set. Had a lot of trouble in this area of the film with the construction. We kept moving scenes around to try and get the best rhythm, to get the best kind of narrative energy. And if you're very beady-eyed, you'll notice that she had a shawl in the previous scene, which she doesn't have on this one. That was just one of the victims of moving stuff around. So this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie, a bold scene, I think, where you see the vulnerability of the villain. One of the attractions of having Carlyle play this role was that he would find other elements in the character. It wouldn't just be simple, beady-eyed, nasty villain. There would be other elements to play. And in a way, that all came from Pierce. Pierce wanted depth and complexity in the scene, so you couldn't have him playing complicated scenes and everybody else doing simple, one-dimensional stuff. So that really made us work on this relationship, particularly between these two, to give it some interesting dimensions. And difficult stuff, too, because we've seen Elektra in bed with Bond. Now we see her with Renard. Who are we rooting for? But of course, by this time, we know she's the bad girl. So it seemed to me that this scene could have almost as much heat as the Bond scene, without making her any less potent or attractive. When we showed the film to the American censors for the first time, they said, this stuff is too sexy, and he had a heart attack. I thought, what am I going to do? In the end, they seemed to forget about that and let it go, but I thought this was really good, powerful stuff, which I would have been very loath to have to lose. And this is Miss Dench making her debut as an action queen, as it were. So we're proud of this. This we shot in Azerbaijan, in Baku. Startling images, never been put on film before. This huge city that was built in the Caspian by the Russians in the early 70s. But this is Peter Lamont's creation on the back lot at Pinewood, which is a kind of seamless match, I think, to the real location. This is the beginning of a huge action scene. So Adrian Biddle and I started this. We did this stuff. So we set the tone for the lighting, for the steam, for the whole look of the sequence. And then the second unit would move in and start doing some of the more elaborate stunt work. But we set the visual style, the look of this particular location. This is a funny little scene which I never really wanted to shoot, and Barbara insisted I did it, and of course she was right. But you'll see it's a little thin on the ground in cover. I never thought it would end up in the movie. So we shot this sequence first. Again, we shot it on location, on the back lot, for real at night. Because as you're going to see, the whole set falls down, so there was no way we could put this in the comfort of a studio. We had to go through the agonies of winter nights in England in February. Some of the most uncomfortable weather on the planet. And we needed to do this because, again, we wanted to set the style of the whole piece. So the second unit, photographically, that's Jonathan Taylor, who was a second unit DP, and Vic would have something to follow. This was always going to be perhaps the most difficult action scene because it was going to take the longest to do. I believe we started shooting this at the beginning of January, 1999. And I think the last shots in the sequence were done in May. So it took over 5 months of us in the first unit, the second unit, model shots, shooting helicopters at Aldershot Army Base because we weren't allowed to have real flying helicopters at Pinewood because of the local residents. a number of CGI shots like this one. So the whole thing is perhaps the most complicated mishmash in the entire movie, and very difficult to keep your tabs on it, to figure out whether it's all going to work and whether it'll piece together as whole cloth. These shots in Pierce were done almost the last things. We put the sequence together with the wider shots that the first unit had done, with all the stunts at the second unit, and then pieced in what we needed of Pierce. A couple of nights of just doing close-ups of him all over the place, looking right, left, up, down, throwing smoke, flames, everything at him. Now this is the car. I think the problem we had with the car was that in Tomorrow Never Dies, there had been this magnificent car sequence, and I didn't want to have anything to do with trying to beat that. It would be unbeatable. So we had the idea of setting the car up as this tremendously potent weapon, and then wiping it out. I think a lot of people were disappointed by that when they saw the film. They wanted a good old Bond car chase, one of the icons of the franchise, but unlucky this time. You had a good one in the last film, so you'll have to wait. Again, a lot of complicated model CGI, post-production work, model work, to put this all together. All these are model shots, of course. I think this sequence speaks a lot to Pierce's athleticism. He had to do a lot of the running around on very treacherous ground here. But his willingness to take part in stunts, I think, gives the whole sequence much more urgency. You're not forever obliged just to be doing wide shots of stunt doubles and then cutting in close-ups. There was a lot of the running and jumping that Pierce was doing, this particular sequence. Again, that was shot over maybe a month, 4 or 5 shots. He did a lot of this work himself. Tremendous skill with all the matching that of the photographers of Jonathan and Adrian. And this is real stuff. This was the set come crashing down. No model stuff there. Again, dangerous work, and I think with Bond action sequences, because they're so real, it can be very hair-raising. Always gives me a pain in the stomach, in a sense, when I see what people have to go through to get shots. Someone has to make those jumps. Someone has to land on that walkway. There's no disguising it. So all this was difficult stuff, to keep it moving, to get the story going, to try and remember where the drama is, where the story was up to keep Zukoski and Christmas alive while Bond is doing his stuff in the caviar factory itself. We must have cut this 100 times to get the balance right between keeping the elements of the story going. One of our most difficult sequences. And I think one we were fairly ruthless with. It's so easy to get in love with all the stunts and all the drama of it, all the dramatics of it. But in fact, you've got to keep the story moving. You can't just, I think, do grandstand effects and grandstand stunts and expect the audience to stay clued in, to stay interested. This is perhaps our most difficult CGI element, to have these blades flying around looking as though they're going anywhere near Robbie. Miracle to me how they do it. And then to my nemesis, the caviar, which when I shot with the stunt double jumping in was beautiful and thick. And then it sort of evaporated when I came to do the scene, so it doesn't look much like caviar. so I regarded as the residue of caviar. That's my justification. And this was hell for Coltrane because it was his birthday. What a way to spend your birthday. We all sang to him, but I don't think it made it any easier. Spending a day and a half on his knees in this stuff. I think we used sort of materials that you put wallpaper on with, that kind of disgusting sticky glue or whatever. So it was a difficult couple of nights for him, but he was pretty public-spirited about it. And when I finished shooting the scene, I thought there's something missing to it. We'd done all this stuff of the building being sliced, but I thought, I think the whole building's got to come collapsing down on top of them. It feels as though we'd been building up to that, but we hadn't got it in the script. So, a couple of weeks after we'd finished the sequence, I took a small unit out there one night, and we blew the whole set up. It just gave the kind of climax to the scene I think we had kind of missed when we wrote it, but because I was cutting the scene and looking at it all the time, I felt we needed that big punchline to it, that visual punch. Fun to do, but only one take. Now back on the Bosphorus. I remember when I was shooting this, I had a kind of out-of-body experience. It was late one night, we were shooting these real tankers coming down the Bosphorus, and I had a call, what I ring John Richardson, who was doing the model unit in the Caribbean, and we figured out that we were actually shooting consecutive shots, 6,000 miles apart, however many time zones apart. I was doing the tanker, and at that precise moment, he was doing the piece of the submarine moving. I wonder how often that happens. This is a skillful model shot with this huge submarine we built, 45 foot of it. I think the bigger the model, the better it looks on film. But when they were shooting it in the Caribbean, they had to find 100 feet of water to shunt it around. So by the time we came to do this scene, we didn't have much money left for location, so we used the old generating part at Pinewood, dressed it up a bit, and moved everybody in. Probably got away with it. So sometimes, even on a budget the size of this, you have to think on your feet and make bricks out of straw. But again, this is a tough expositional scene. A lot of the plot is explained here. So I didn't think it needed a too strong a visual identity. We needed to follow what was being said. So I was happy to compromise on this location if I could use the money elsewhere. I think directing a film like this, directing any film, you always have to make these value judgments. What to give away and what to hang on to.
Contaminating the Bosphorus for decades. And there'd be only one way to get the oil out.
So I don't think in the end the scene looks shortchanged. Although at the time it gave me a certain panic.
Captain Nikolai!
Here the miracle of green screen. Motion control cameras, all new to me, all a mystery to me, but stuff I had to learn to do the job and to hold it all together. Now this scene pleased me because there was nothing much written here and we really made this up as we went along to get some drama out of the clock. We puzzled about it. I can't remember what the script said, but it was very, very thrown away. And just by keeping our nerve, although everybody was hanging around, it was a tough schedule. We had a lot to do. We had to shoot Judy out. I remember we kind of kept our nerve and figured this little scene out, and it's rather a dramatic little scene. Hard to believe that it wasn't written as it turned up in the script. It has a nice irony that Electra makes her one serious mistake at this point. Gives M the clock. That single act kind of undoes the whole caboodle for Renard and Electra. Again, I seem to remember a lot of editing issues around here, construction issues, to keep M alive, to keep this part of the story going. We split the scene, the first part you saw a couple of scenes ago, and this is the second part, but it was all written as one. But to keep M alive and Electra alive, we chucked the whole thing in a hat and see what came out. That was a dangerous stunt. We actually set fire to Pierce on that. His shoes were alight. Here again, the magic of green screen. I shot the plates in Istanbul, and this was the back lot at Pinewood.
After you. I insist.
Again, more of the stuff that I shot in my few days in Istanbul to try and deliver the place, to give a real sense of the city without spending much time there and without having any of the principal actors. So this is our first look at what proves to be the most complicated, difficult set in the movie. The famous submarine, which is going to play a huge role in the climax to the film. Wanted to get a lot of movement into this scene so I could put the geography of the set in the audience's mind. Not a lot is happening, but you see all the main locations are going to become important later on. Very few chances to establish that submarine without a lot of action in it, so had a lot of thought to try and explain it visually before things got out of control. And again, this is a very telling and emotional scene, not one you're likely to see in many films with the villain and the villainess. But again, I think emotional and powerful. And people who have seen the film say you feel sorry for Carlyle at this point. Both in the scene in the bed with Sophie and this, you get a sense of his loss and pain. So again, it's a measure to Carlyle's power as an actor that without compromising his potency as the villain, you can make these moves with him and even make him vulnerable and almost sweet at times. So this was a very difficult scene, this garrote scene on many fronts. I didn't think it looks difficult when you see it, but it took forever to shoot. Huge number of shots, huge amount of cover. And as you see, as the scene will develop, we were full of doubts and anxieties about how violent and vicious the scene should be. So once we put Pierce in the chair, and she starts to go to work on him, we did many, many different versions of it, really not knowing what we'd end up using, how violent, how unpleasant, how powerful, whatever word you can think of. We just shot a lot of material here, so we could decide later to get the exact tone of this scene. Gruesome stuff. All this is based on real research.
Don't you?
Where's Em?
Soon she'll be everywhere.
All this because you fell for Renan.
Five more turns.
So there's a lot of coverage in this. I think this film, this, a lot of coverage in this. I think this scene took me the best part of 6 days to shoot, plus an insert unit coming in to doing shots of nuts and bolts in this particular piece. Again, we really didn't know how far we could go with this. How strangulated Pierce should be. How sweaty he should be. So it was a question of just trying different things and deciding later what to use. And here's a wonderful shot. Still don't know how they did it. Amazing piece of CGI to keep the ear firm and steady with all the movement she's doing and the imperceptible camera movement. But this is really a triumph for Sophie, this scene. This is the one she had to pull off, where we really see her vicious and nasty. If she's going to deserve the end which is about to come to her, she really has to deliver villainy here. I knew she could do the vulnerability and the victim at the beginning of the film. I knew that Bond could fall in love with her. I knew you could believe the love story. But now she had to do the really vicious, nasty stuff, mixed with this strange concoction of sexuality, childishness, and cruelty. I think she really pulls this off. A real tour de force for Sophie. Also a nice piece of design by Peter Lamont to give me space and texture, and yet it still bears some relation to the exteriors we had. We have this difficult stuff coming up with insides and outs, and to get the kind of sense of proportions accurate and still give me a chance to have room to stage stuff and to do a lot of action. Very difficult. That's the funniest line in the movie, which again the American censors asked me to cut, but fortunately after I trimmed down some of the violence, they seemed to forget their objections to that. That would have been another great loss. Here comes Superman, Batman, Coltrane, action hero. So the end of a nice performance by Goldie, who had really hadn't done much acting. But when I saw him, when he read for me, I knew he could do it. So this took a long time to shoot again. The rhythm of it and the pace of it was hard to sense until we started editing it. So this was material where I felt it needed a lot of cover. A lot of different angles. And I remember when we first cut the film's short change in this section and going back into it and really extending it. An interesting and dramatic moment. Normally in the editing process you find shortening stuff, moving it along, but here I had enough material to slow it all down and try and get as much drama and excitement as I could. I think that's a rarity with editing, when you actually make things longer than you intended. Particularly in a film like this, when always the impulse is to keep the story moving, to keep it going. And Sophie too was game about doing stunts. There was no way we could have done this action without her being prepared to do it, and her being prepared to be flung across the set. There was simply no room to have put a stunt double in. So she was very game for all that. Everybody was. This next little sequence is a tremendous piece of design. Built in pine wood, the texture is magnificent. The finish on the walls, the stairways, really accomplished. Everywhere you look, the detail is perfect. And it was really about two or three floors, which we just shot every which way. But I think it fools a lot of people. Where did you shoot that, they say? Where did you find this castle? Nope. Sticks and mortar and cardboard. So here we come to one of the most troubling moments in the film, the killing of Elektra. There's a lot of discussion between all of us, the studio, the Broccolis, about the viability of Bond killing Elektra in cold blood. I think our position was this was equal opportunity villainy. If she was a villain, she should go the way of all Bond villains. But there was a problem, a worry whether an audience would accept this. So it was slightly with my heart in my mouth when we previewed this, that I put this scene in front of the audience and lo and behold, no one mentioned it. They seemed to take it for what it was. They understood it in the context of the film and in the context of what Bond had to do. If they'd found problems with it or given me a hard time about it, I don't know what I would have done. We really had nothing else up our sleeve. So it was a scary moment, and it has this rather touching end to it, a memory of what they once had between them. This little section always makes me laugh, because I think in the space of about 4 seconds you have three different Bonds. You have obviously Pierce up there doing this stuff, you have a Turkish stand-in stood on Maiden's Tower in the Bosphorus, and you have the double doing the dive. So now, this was a nightmare for Pierce. I kept saying to him, save some energy for the last month of the movie, because this is the submarine scene and it better be good. It's what people are going to remember. So he really earned his money on this. He was drenched wet for a month, doing all this very, very difficult stuff. And it was my worry that we'd all be worn out after 5 months of shooting. We'd have nothing left for this particular scene, but we did. I think it says a lot to my energy and discipline that I managed to keep it going through all this. You always run down towards the end of a movie, but I knew that this was crucial and difficult, and that we all had to have our wits about us. So this was a massively complicated set, built in all sorts of bits and pieces, with hydraulics, because as we'll see, the set moves up and down, built on pine wood, again with an astounding amount of detail. One of the art directors, Fred Holt, spent his whole time on the movie designing this. He started in September, and we shot it in June. And I remember being overwhelmed around December when he would keep coming to me with questions about it. Do I want this? Do I want that? And I would say, I can't deal with it. I've got so much else to do. But I knew that if I didn't deal with it then, cometh June, I'd be in trouble. That was a time, I think, when I felt, I'll never get through the film. It's overwhelming, making decisions about what was to be shot in June, 6 months previously. But I stuck at it, and Fred was very patient with me, and it did all work when it came to it. Also tough for Denise, this. A lot of stunts for her, and again, there was only a limit we could do with stunt doubles. So this, all these guys in here are stunt guys. We had to use them as actors because what was going to happen was so difficult. There was no question of using real actors and then doubling them with stuntmen. We had to find stuntmen who could really look right and really do the business for us. So this is where the whole scene starts to take off, and this was horrendously difficult. The set moved through 90 degrees, so for every shot we had to line the shot up, attach everything to the floor, strap down the camera, the lights, and then put the set into moving mode, shoot it, then put it on the level again, redo it, and if it was okay, then rehearse the next scene, the next shot, attach all the equipment to the floor and move the set again. This thing personally drove me crazy. Some days I only managed to do 2 shots. And this was the only time on the film that Vic and I were actually working together. We were on adjoining stages at Pinewood. He would be doing this kind of stuff with the stunt guys. I would be doing that kind of stuff with Bobby and Pierce and Denise. And we could actually run across to each other and see what we were both doing, which made it a little easier with all the other sequences we did with all the other second unit. I would be doing one sequence and Vic would be doing something completely different, but for the only time in the movie we were working together. I remember doing this shot, and this shot I never turned until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which is not my style. I nearly had a nervous breakdown doing this stuff. It was very, very difficult. Tons of water. Not only did the set go on hydraulics and swivel through 90 degrees, but it was also built into a tank. So these kind of sequences, we could lower the set into the water. So you could get water coming up at them as well as water being pumped in on the actors. Very difficult and dangerous stuff to do. A shot like this top shot would simply take hours to rig and set up. This was a very difficult part of storytelling, and I went back and did a lot of these inserts after I'd finished shooting the film, after we'd previewed it, to an audience seemed confused about exactly what Bond was doing, which hatches were opening and what his game was. So I went back in and did a lot of little inserts of buttons and flashing lights and whatever, and I think it kind of made it clear this is difficult stuff to do as well, for Pierce submerging himself in water, and it's all dangerous and heart-stopping. And this sequence with Bond climbing out of the submarine, swimming alongside the submarine, was another mishmash of model stuff, double stuff, green screen. We seem to be shooting bits and pieces of this forever. We built a small part of the set for that, and other shots are just against a green screen, and Myra Bryan's put in backgrounds for it and whatever, but it seems seamless, and Denise really went through it here. All this is kind of scary, her being underwater, her having tons of water hurled at her. And she was very game and very brave with all this, because, and I think it justified the casting. I needed an actress who was prepared to do action work and was good at it and athletic enough to do it. There's no way round a stunt double here. You have to do it yourself. And she really got stuck in. I mean, that kind of shot. It looks hard, and it was hard. So whenever I see this sequence, it just fills me with dread. I start to perspire at the memory of how long it took and how hard it was. But it seems good. It seems effective. And this is the beginning of the whole last sequence, with, again, very difficult to shoot. The set we first seen when Renard walked on the first time, we had seen it horizontal, now it's perpendicular. So the whole set was surrounded by an amazing amount of structure, so we could put lights and the camera equipment on it. And this fight was a mixture of the real actors doing a lot of it and also stunt doubles. But again, water being pumped in, wind being pumped in. The set very, very slippery, very difficult. Again in a tank, so this kind of shot we could throw water up from underneath into it. This fight would have taken the best part of a week to shoot, so you can imagine what they went through, drenched for a week. And no one was hurt, miraculously, despite all the climbing around on these narrow pipes. No damage was done. Simon Crane rehearsed this for about a week on the set, with a video camera going through it with the stunt guys, and then we showed it to Bobby and to Pierce and have them match it. But this took a lot of preparation, a lot of shooting. And this is, of course, is this moment here is where Bobby has to really deliver the great climax to his performance, when Pierce tells him Elektra's dead. My heart was in my mouth when he did it. Would he be able to pull it off? And there it is. Unfortunately, his makeup was running at the time, but It was such a brilliant performance, such a wonderful anguish moment that I let the makeup go. His performance was so powerful, so electrifying, that it didn't worry me that the stuff was running. So now the climax of it. Again, a sequence which gave me a lot of trouble in the cutting of driving along and trying to figure out what's going on and trying to figure out what was going on, the stuff with the steam pipe I shot subsequently. That was an idea we had after we put the scene together and in fact previewed it, that it needed another element, that we needed to establish that steam pipe. So I went back in and did a couple of inserts on it, and to try and make it clear exactly what was happening, that he was putting steam into the chamber and he would eventually blow out the plutonium rod. And again, another tricky issue here for the censor, that when we first designed this, we were going to have Carlisle Renard impaled on those equipment behind him, and we had the whole machinery built that he would be pushed back and the pipes would come through him. But we thought, we'll never get away with this, we'll never get the 12 or 13 rating. So we designed, almost a day before we shot it, this other idea of the pipe going into his stomach and knocking him down off his perch and onto the floor. So now, to all intents and purposes, the movie's over. Renard is dead. And the challenge for me here is to get out of the movie as quickly as I can, to get them from where they were in the nuclear reactor room up and out of the torpedo room as soon as possible. I just felt speed was of the essence here. As few shots and as quick action as I could get. There was nothing left for us. We just had to finish the movie as quickly as we could. And I'm pleased with this. I think that once Renard is killed, then there's a huge amount of energy and twists and turns and jokes, but it all kind of comes piling on you straight after each other. No time to even draw breath before we bring the story to a close. The poor doubles in Istanbul who had to do this shot nearly died of hypothermia. And again here, quite a bit of story to tell, but speed to me was of the essence. We reintroduce M to her workers with classic English understatement, the briefest of nods, and she's back at work. And now to get good jokes if we can. After all the drama, to end the film with as much humour as we could muster up. And this was Denise's one chance to look glamorous, one chance to have a lovely costume and a nice hairdo. After all the water and the grime and the action and the sweat. Again, a complicated little video CGI sequence. But again, keep the jokes coming at you. Useful to have Mr. Cleese in this, with his dry sense of humour and his comic timing. And of course, Jude is no slouch when it comes to witty repartee.
It's getting redder.
But no lingering here. Just good jokes and out of the movie. Hopefully one good line topping another. With this, we hope, the real topper.
I thought Christmas only comes once a year.
And before we get any romantic ideas, back into the Bond theme and let's get ready for the next one. So it was fun to do. I didn't think it would be so much fun, but it was. Everybody was nice and jolly, and we all got through it. People seemed to like it, so what more could you want? Hope you enjoyed it.